The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about what happens when something that seems like a great thing at first goes to the dark side and takes you with it. I'm your host, Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm also your host, Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy. Sarah and I met, fell in love in a, quote, self-help organization that turned out to be a mega cult called Nexium. Heard of it? We got out of there together, and on our way out, we helped shut it down. Our journey as Nexium whistleblowers was captured in detail on a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, and also on the front page of a newspaper.
New York Times, babe.
Right.
Have you heard of it? Each week on A Little Bit Culty, we talk with other former cult members and whistleblowers, plus experts in things like cultic abuse and coercive control.
We also turn the mic over to advocates and clinicians with wisdom to share on recovering from everything from MLMs and toxic religion to bad romances with raging narcissists.
There's always something to learn about the cultiverse. Be sure to subscribe to A Little Bit Culty so you don't miss an episode. Find us on Instagram and at alittlebitculty.com.
Well, 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 look at what we have here. Another episode of ALBC.
Another day, another pod.
Mm-hmm.
How you doing?
I'm good. What were you talking about before we started here? You wanted to drop some knowledge or something like that?
I was just thinking about how interesting it's been since we had the two episodes with Jennings, one about Teal Swan, one about Fellowship of Friends. But since then, there's probably been more activity regarding Teal Swan and The Deep End out on multiple networks now, Spark in Canada and Hulu in the US. And people are really not only quite disturbed by the series itself, but by watching her response on her blog. And I really encourage people to go there and to look at it, to really see how somebody responds who's just really not willing to take responsibility.
But pretending to. Right.
I also think it's really interesting that of all of the 40 plus episodes we've done now, there's been no group that we've looked at that has had followers that have attacked us or come back to tell us that we are bad people more so than the Teal followers.
But how many is that? I mean,
there's definitely more than any of the other groups, and we've looked at a lot of groups. It's interesting that this is a spiritual group and I find them quite hateful, actually, and quite
not
hurtful.
Not so spiritual, actually. Someone said that you weren't so spiritual one time. Wasn't that true?
My dear friend, Alistair Abel, who introduced me to the world of voiceover and Walla 20 years ago. Some people here in Vancouver may know Al Abel. He's a legend. He said I wasn't very spiritual. I said, not so spiritual. And I, ever since then, was trying to prove how spiritual, in fact, I was.
And that's when you went out and got your, like, spiritual gangster t-shirt.
I think I had to join a cult to prove how fucking spiritual I was.
Thanks to Al Abel.
Al Abel, jeez. It's all your fault. He's going to love that one.
I just blamed it on him.
Blame it all. But you know what? I wanted to say something because I do hope the Teal Swan followers are listening to this. And I want to just say, like, truly from the heart, like, not cheesy, like, love and light, but, like, truly as a empathetic person, I understand where you're coming from, because when I was in Nexium and people talk shit about Keith and the community, I was like, you don't, how dare you even pretend that you know, because you've never even met him. You've never met him. You've never taken the classes. How would you trust something that's on the internet more than me? I'm talking about my experience. Like, that was really hurtful. So I get it. I just want you to know that when you're in something like this and it's good, and you're vested in it being good, it's really hard to see the bad. You don't want to see the bad because that means something about you and the choices that you've made. So you tend to block those things out. You don't know what you're looking at until you're out of it. And so all I will say is, as somebody who defended the goodness and was never willing to look at the bad, I just encourage you to do your own research, because if there's nothing bad there, you'll still use the tools that you've learned and you'll keep on trucking. you know, there's nothing wrong with watching these series and taking note. If people are hurt, it doesn't mean that you can't leave with your good experiences intact, but you may want to look at what's happened to other people and get out before it happens to you. That's all I want to say.
No, that's a good point, because you can keep some of the good and make the necessary pivot with a more informed decision, which is really what all this is about. It's informing you to make better decisions for your life.
And we have seen some interesting dialogue about, you know, how the media can be edited to be, you know, to present a false narrative. And certainly we saw that in the case of Sarma. I just really strongly think that that's not what's happening in this case. And there may have been, you know, ominous music or whatever things edited, but like there's enough sound bites that are clean and unedited that are still equally as disturbing just watching the series.
And we have an episode coming up
about that. That's next, actually. So today we have a guest named Nat Feinblatt, but next week we interview the director and the producer of The Deep End. So your homework is to finish it if you haven't already. I do love giving homework, don't I?
No, you're like the substitute teacher, like gives homework and everyone's just like, yeah, okay.
I'm back with my clipboard.
Your clipboard.
Hey guys, guess who's getting promoted today?
Oh God.
So that's your homework, yes. And what else do we have to share? Oh, we were in Dax Shepard, Armchaired and Dangerous with Dax Monica and David Ferreira.
Armchaired and Dangerous.
It's an offshoot of Armchair Expert. And that was a really nice shout out. I mean,
it was, yeah.
To have like our, you know, one of our personal heroes speak highly.
I think he said there's two dudes on the dock who are reconciling Keith's achievements at 11. I think he's referring to the scene in The Vow when I was just rolling my eyes at the fact that Keith put judo champ age 11 on his resume.
That's definitely one of my favorite scenes from The Vow.
Well, it's not a scene. We're just having a conversation,
but
it's just
favorite
more
moments.
Recapping, like, if you have to put anything on your resume that you achieved when you were 11 years old,
you should definitely take note of that.
If anyone has an achievement from fifth grade on their resume, just chuck it.
Check it.
All right. What else?
Let's introduce our guest. Here's the question. Have you ever asked yourself, wait, am I in a cult? Or thought, I have to get out of here? Or if you're at the I'm out and now I have nothing stage of cult recovery, our guest today wants you to know that there is help out there and you don't have to do it alone with your healing process.
Serendipitous, because we just had some people ask us about a healing process. So this is the episode. Dr. Natalie Feinblatt is a licensed clinical psychologist in private practice in Los Angeles, California, who specializes in the treatment of addiction and trauma. And one of her trauma subspecialties is working with former cult members. She received her BA from UCSD, that's University of California at San Diego, and her master's and doctorate from Pepperdine University, where she wrote her doctoral dissertation on psychotherapy with former cult members and has specialized in helping them ever since. She also does EMDR, brain spotting, and other trauma-specific therapies.
She was also featured on the series finale of Leah Remini, Scientology and the Aftermath. No big deal. It's a freaking big deal. She joins us today to talk about what it takes to help ex-cult members make the transition to their former, true, pre-cult identities, and what helps when it comes to standing strong in the face of exit fallout. Super excited to share a very practical, tool-oriented episode with Dr. Natalie Feinblatt. Hi, Natalie.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Welcome to A Little Bit Culty.
I am super happy to be here.
So many people reach out to us. Can you recommend therapists or psychologists who have a cult background? And that's something that we certainly at least recommend, at least, you know, people are reaching out if you can find that.
Yeah.
Or someone who's at least trauma-informed, but you have both. You're trauma-informed and you have a cult education.
Yes, I am. So I'm happy to be here and I'm always happy to talk about it. So my father worked in the film industry for his entire career and he does like picture cars. So he worked on the Tom Cruise movie Days of Thunder.
Cool trickle.
Yeah.
Cool trickle. Yeah. I'm familiar with his wins.
Yeah. And I was about 10 at the time, which when I went back and did the math on that, I was like, geez, Louise, I've been interested in this since I was 10. All the grownups were talking about how Tom Cruise was a Scientologist. And I was like, what's that? And no one could answer my question, which seemed really weird, you know?
Yeah.
In spite of my last name, I was raised Catholic. And like, you know, somebody asks you, what is the Catholic Church? You can kind of give them a rundown of it. Or, you know, what is being Jewish involved? People can give you a rundown of that. But nobody could tell me what Scientology was or what these people did. And it just stuck in my head as like, well, that's weird. Why do all of these people know about this, but nobody actually knows what it is, right? So fast forward maybe 7 or 8 years and the internet becomes a thing. right? And so curious me, one day I was just like, oh, it wasn't Google back then. There wasn't a Google. Maybe it was Yahoo or AltaVista or something. I don't
remember. Jeeves.
Yeah, ask Jeeves. What is Scientology? And that got me into the burgeoning world online of former Scientologists who were connecting with each other and kind of starting to expose the truth about this organization. And it just fascinated me. So I just spent hours and hours reading everything I could online, looking at some books that were in existence at that point. And then that kind of led me to the broader just cult discussion and reading and listening and watching. And so from high school to dissertation, I was just somebody who was really, really interested in cults and not just from like a true crime angle, but it also really interested me the ways in which cults impact people and how they try to heal after being in an organization like a cult. And so when it came time to write my dissertation, anybody who's done one probably goes through a similar process where you're supposed to pick a bunch of topics and then narrow it down. And that was one of my many topics, and it got narrowed down and narrowed down. And eventually that was the winner.
What was the title?
Oh my gosh. What was the title?
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
It's been a while.
Yeah. Number one, it's been a while. And number two, I think anybody who's written a dissertation will tell you that no matter how much you love the topic, by the time you're done with your dissertation, you want nothing to do with it.
I hear you.
You're just done.
I feel that way about my essays in university, so I can't even imagine.
There you go. So it was something like The Effectiveness of Psychotherapy with Former Cult Members, a Literature Review, something along those lines, which pretty much describes what it was. And so, yeah, that's where things got started for me, going from just like interested person to professional and academic work in this area.
Most people, when they hear about a cult, it's the salacious stuff that lures them in. It was more curious for you.
Oh, yeah.
Would you say that it allowed you more room for the human aspect of it, as opposed to what most people are interested in when they watch it? They really just want to prove that it couldn't happen to them.
Right. Yeah. No, I do think that kind of opened me up to the human aspect of it. I just happened to hit, I think, the right place at the right time in terms of getting on that part of the internet at the time that all of these former Scientologists were kind of finding each other, creating community, you know, in open forums for anyone to see, which is what I was looking at. And so that really gave me, it wasn't just the books or the documentaries or whatever. It was like real people telling their real stories about how they were going through what I know now is like PTSD and you know, the effects of coercive control, really being able to see on an individual level what this had done to people and how they were trying to heal from it.
You have a specialty in addiction and trauma.
Correct. Those are my two big areas. The longer I do this work, the more kind of parallels I see between like addiction recovery and cult recovery. They're not the same, obviously. But one of the things is that, you know, you can't really make somebody see the light before they're ready. You can't really make somebody want to change before they're ready, which can be really challenging for like loved ones and family members.
And they may never.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a real possibility.
Yeah, both addictions and cults. Some people don't get there. So that's one of the big similarities I've seen in that kind of work.
How do you think trauma and addiction are related?
Oh boy.
On a Venn diagram.
Well, no, I'm glad you said that, because that's the thing I always say to people is that I started in addiction treatment, and then it didn't take long for me to realize that you can't really specialize in addiction without specializing in trauma, because the Venn diagrams almost completely overlap. Before I was in private practice, I worked in addiction treatment for many years, like detox, residential, intensive outpatient programs, all this. And if I look back and think, how many of the people that I worked with during that time genuinely had no trauma history whatsoever? We're talking hundreds, maybe thousands of people. I can count them on my fingers. And so addiction, in my opinion, a lot of the time is a way to self-medicate and cope with post-traumatic stress, you know, and it's just one way that people do that. And unfortunately, given the nature of substances in the human brain, that can then create an addiction on top of all the post-traumatic stress.
And probably more trauma.
Yeah, exactly. Because you get into all sorts of situations if your addiction's bad enough that create more trauma.
Where does getting involved in a cultic group fit into that Venn diagram?
That's a good question.
From your experience.
Yeah, I mean, I have definitely worked with some folks over the years in addiction treatment who got involved in groups. I mean, you know, I talk about Scientology a lot, but Scientology has Narcanon, which is their rehab front group. And I worked with a few clients over the years who had well-meaning but uninformed loved ones send them to a Narcanon facility, and that never, never went well. Oh, and there's also the whole troubled teen industry thing where a lot of people get thrown into that again, and their family doesn't maybe do quite as much research to see that the place that they're sending them has maybe people online who are saying, don't send anybody here. It's abusive. It's culty.
Right. And just to remind our listeners about Elizabeth Gilpin, who wrote a book called Stolen, whose parents, again, well-meaning, trying to help her deal with basically just being a teenager, but didn't have the tools, and sent her to a group that used the methods of Synanon, which is now a well-known cult, and a lot of troubled teen industry use those same structures that are found in those substance abuse original recovery centers. Is that right?
Yeah. Synanon was definitely a thing here in LA. I think it was like in the 70s, early 80s.
Yes.
That kind of got busted, but it fractured in a bunch of different directions, and a bunch of people who had kind of been bigwigs there went off to do their own thing, including founding these, you know, therapeutic boarding schools, quote unquote, that just recycled a lot of this, you know, really abusive Synanon treatment, again, quote unquote.
Right.
It's not treatment, it's abuse. But yeah, unfortunately, and some of those places are still out there and operating.
Have you heard of CRLA?
Oh, yes. The
the one with Chris Batham?
Chris Batham, yeah. That was a whole big thing.
CRLA with Chris Batham. 80% natural ingredients, take one a day.
It indoctrinates you.
We have an interview lined up with one of the survivors of that group, which is, super cultic, but it also bridges this sort of therapy, recovery, culty behavior, narcissistic leader group, which seems to be consistent.
He's a great example of how there's a lot of corruption in addiction treatment, a lot of unethical stuff that goes on, like body brokering. And
what's body brokering?
Oh, boy.
asking a lot of questions today.
So body brokering is when treatment facilities will have a staff member whose job it is to essentially pay people to come to treatment in order to use their insurance benefits.
Right.
This will often involve paying for that person to relapse if they've been sober for a while, because insurance won't pay if you come in clean. This is a whole world, you guys. You can.
It's a major insurance fraud.
Major insurance fraud. And it's also incredibly dangerous for people who are struggling with their recovery, because people who are, you know, kind of semi in recovery get to know these body brokers, and they just hop from facility to facility getting paid to go from place to place, to stay there for 30 days, leave, relapse, go to another place. And obviously, when you're dealing with a life or death illness like addiction, this kills people, right? Like, they don't always make it to the next place.
It has a built-in argument too, because if you call someone on that, you're being insensitive to their addiction. Wow.
It's protected. Jesus. It's like instant gaslighting. Wow. I mean, I don't want to give anything away for the episode about CRLA, but I remember thinking, wait, Chris is taking this woman out for a drink? They're going out for a drink? I thought they were supposed to be in recovery. Yep. What the F? Okay. Yeah. But we'll save that for another episode.
I noticed that once you bust one of these, there's a lot of spinoffs.
Oh, yeah. There's always lots of spinoffs. I mean, there are so many spinoffs of Scientology. There's one called Avatar. There's another one. Landmark Forum has a little bit of Scientology in it. You know, people go to these groups, take certain things, and then kind of build their own little thing around it. Or the group ends and it splinters and it goes off in a bunch of different directions.
That's actually another episode I'm trying to work on is doing this whole like tree of like, when was the first large group awareness training, right? And what, like, I think it was around like LifeSpring, and then was it Werner Erhard spent time in Scientology and made LifeSpring, and then LifeSpring turned into Est, which turned into Landmark, and Keith went to science, you know, took from Scientology. Like, it's just a freaking hodgepodge of the same shit.
Bunch in different of formats. Narcissists just stealing ideas and then going and making their own harmful thing.
Yeah. And then charging a lot of money for it.
Yeah. That too, of course. Let's not forget about that.
Well, given your background, since you were looking at this since you were 10, when did you hear about NXIVM and what did you think?
Oh, gosh.
What's your first impression?
I first heard of NXIVM, I want to say, like, maybe when I was in my master's program. It was that one guy's website whose name I'm blanking on.
Rick Ross.
No, it was Rick Ross, but the other guy that worked for
Frank Parlato.
Yes.
Frank Parlato.
Frank Parlato and his stuff. And Rick Ross and Frank Parlato. I remember at the time just thinking like, oh God, here's another one. Mm-hmm. Sounds like they're taking the whole psychology self-help route versus the spiritual route. And I would check in on it, you know, every 6 months or a year to see if there were any like developments or anything. I remember being really concerned. And actually, you guys can tell me about this because I think this was in the documentary that Keith has a kid, right?
He's got two now. Yeah.
Two.
At the time.
Okay. Yeah, it was one. And I remember reading, and this may or may not be true, that like they were like, oh, we're going to try to raise this kid like in the perfect way to be like the most smart, sane person.
Do you want to hear what we were told?
Sure.
And what it was?
Yeah.
At some point in the community, I want to say it was like 2008, 2009. I actually don't know. I was a couple of years into the program. I don't remember what year he was born. But all of a sudden, this baby appeared on the scene. Now, listen, I didn't live in Albany. Like, we used to come and go. And the story that we were told is that Barbara Jeske, who's since passed of cancer, and that is a separate long story we could do a whole episode on, and why all the women around him were dying of cancer. Pause that. She was in her like late 50s, I think, and she showed up with this baby. And what we were told is a friend of hers from childhood died tragically in an accident. And basically she was going to be the godmother. And so she was bringing this baby into the community and we were all going to raise it community style. And it just so happened that Kristen Keefe, who was his sort of like, sorry, Keith's like right-hand legal liaison woman, wanted to sort of be the primary caregiver because Barbara was a bit older. And then this rainbow program was developed and Keith had this theory about like teaching the children multiple languages and the baby learned 11 languages and had 11 different caregivers. And the premise was that when you were with the, you know, the Mandarin speaking nanny, when you were with that nanny, you only had Mandarin and you were only Spanish and he was learning Hindi and Russian and French and a bunch of different things. Anyway, we found out later, like after we left, because we spoke to Kristen, it was Kristen's baby.
Oh my.
Kristen had the baby. Up until now, she'd had abortions and all the women around Keith had had abortions. And I don't know if she refused the abortion or there was past the time that she could have the abortion. And they basically, like we had been told that she was sick and in the hospital, so we never saw her pregnant. Mm-hmm. And then at the hospital, I think it was Pam and somebody else convinced her to adopt. The agreement they came up with is that she could keep the baby as long as no one knew it was hers. And that so they came up with that story about how Barbara inherited the baby.
Oh my goodness.
So if anyone's still in Nexium, like the loyalists are listening to it and they're like fighting for how Keith is so honorable and good, it's why the fuck would they do that whole scheme? Oh, because he's not celibate now.
Well, their capacity to lie and the ways that they lied, we completely underestimated.
If you think he's the most noble man in the world and he's so good and he's the next Jesus slash Buddha slash whatever. But if you think that about somebody, like if you truly imagine in your mind just for a minute that you think that about somebody and then you find out that they lie like that, you go, well, they had to do that for a reason. The community wasn't integrated enough to understand this concept. So it was an ethical lie.
Right.
Everything can be dismissed on that assumption. Keith is a good man. He knows what he's doing. It's an ethical lie.
Right.
No problem. That's how they justified. Anyway, so you heard about the baby and you were worried.
I was worried. I was like, oh no, there is this little kid in there being raised by who knows who. I mean, my goodness, that caught my attention. And then obviously I was paying attention to when, you know, your story broke and then like kind of the snowball started going down the hill and then everybody knew about it.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sweet.
But yeah, it was just one of those groups. And we see this happening more and more now, which is great, where it's a group that certain people have known about for a really long time that's finally getting, you know, journalistic attention and people are speaking out and they have platforms. And it's like, oh, thank goodness, this is finally going in hopefully a better direction.
Well, information has been decentralized a lot. So, you know, in the past, to get your story out there, you had to pass a lot of guardians at the gates for media. But now you can tell your story. And if someone, like in our case, is interested in it, they can actually take it through due process.
Oh, We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org.
Do you think people in your field are waking up to it, what it looks like, what it sounds like? What do you think they most need to know about this field, what the trauma looks like, and to create a safe space?
I think we're getting better. We're definitely not where we need to be, but I think we are getting better. Even if you're not somebody who specializes in working with trauma, you can still have a trauma-informed practice and come from a trauma-informed place. Mm-hmm. And I think that that alone is extremely helpful in this regard, because this is a very specific type of trauma that people undergo when they're in these sorts of groups or relationships. I definitely think we still have a ways to go. I can fill you in on this person offline, but I actually got connected to another therapist here in LA, and we had coffee yesterday, who also specializes in this. And neither of us had known each other. Somebody that happened to know us both were like, do you guys know each other?
Wait, who is it?
Her name is Quincy Gideon, Dr. Quincy Gideon.
Never heard of her.
Me neither.
I need her on my list.
Well, that was my question. It's like, do you guys have a peer review? You bounce things off? Is there a system, you know?
I will answer that question. But, you know, so it was great for us to be able to meet each other. She reached out to me. So we had coffee yesterday. And we both kind of commiserated about how, you know, we still see a lot of clients who come in and who say, I saw this well-meaning, but not very well-informed therapist who wasn't super trauma-informed and really had no idea about coercive control or how abusive groups operate. But we're also glad that we're able to find each other and to make these mm-hmm. connections, because this isn't a huge group of people that do this kind of work. Nippy, to answer your question, there isn't really any sort of centralized hub for people who do this kind of work. Like, the only one I can think of is ICSA, the International Cultic mm-hmm. Studies Association. But again, mm-hmm. like, not everybody belongs to ICSA.
And it's more academic, like, it's not necessarily mm-hmm. therapy support.
The academic part of it is definitely bigger than the clinical part of
yes.
it, for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still refer people to them, like survivors, because I think the portion of them that is survivors helping other survivors is incredibly helpful.
When fields are kind of evolving, I imagine they have their rites of passages to go through.
Definitely. I'm on Instagram a lot, because that's the social media that I've kind of chosen to work with professionally.
Yeah, likewise.
And there's a lot of people on there, thank goodness, who are involved in helping people heal from religious trauma, deconstructing kind of fundamentalist Christianity. I see a lot of growth in that community, which is very much adjacent to this. So that makes me hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you have a different type of intake when you know someone's coming out of a cult? The reason I'm asking is I know that for myself, with a lot of other NXIVM survivors, is that there's been a consistent problem if someone's not totally informed, or they just ask a question that's very similar to the line of questioning that was used in NXIVM, which is so much stolen from actual therapy. So do you have a way of like kind of determining what route you're going to go as a therapist and what to like avoid, so you don't like re-trigger or traumatize someone just in the initial intake?
Yeah, definitely. The way that I do it is, prior to working with somebody, I typically do like a consultation with them just to make sure they're a good fit for me, I'm a good fit for them, etc. And once I figure out what kind of cult experience they're coming from, even if it's a group that I had previously never heard of, I will do my best to look into it a little bit, just so I kind of get an idea, at least on the surface, about mm-hmm. what it was about and what was involved. And I mean, I say this generally, but especially if somebody is coming from a group like NXIVM or any of these other kind of more like self-help or therapy-based groups, you know, I will start off by saying, there's probably stuff that's going to happen in our sessions that might be triggering mm-hmm. for you, things that I'm going to say, or just the way that this process works. And I do my best to let clients know right off the bat that they have the right to speak up and say, that word that you used upset me, or the way that you asked mm-hmm. that upset me, or something about that. And to say, that is a trigger from my experience. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do my best to make space for clients to be able to say that sort of stuff right off the bat, because I would much rather know right away so I can adjust or we can discuss it or whatever it is. And I also think it can be empowering because typically when people come from these sorts of groups, they were never able to do that.
They couldn't even voice that concern.
No, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I try to support them and say, I know that this is probably the opposite of what you're used to. And you're probably going to have to take a leap of faith to see that you can do that and have me not respond the way that people have responded to you in the past. Mm-hmm. But I put it out there right off the bat and I definitely encourage it.
Can you share some of the common symptoms or telltale signs of PTSD proprietary in those clientele? Are there just some right away that you can tell and you know that they're going to be evolved? And then how do you know when they're evolved? Are the signs or symptoms proprietary to cults or are they just trauma and it doesn't matter?
So I guess I could kind of address that in two ways. So on the one hand, yes, trauma is trauma in terms of the way that most symptoms of post-traumatic stress manifest themselves. Not to say that everyone is going to fit the exact diagnostic criteria, like a lock and key. And I try to put it out there that, you know, just because somebody might not meet the exact criteria, it doesn't mean they're not struggling with post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. PTSD is actually kind of a difficult diagnosis to make. Instead of just like, here's a list of, you know, 10 criteria, you have to have five. It's all these subcategories and you have to have a certain amount from each category. But I will say that on the one hand, yes, trauma is trauma in terms of how it shows up in those symptoms. And on the other hand, I think that especially post-traumatic stress related to coercive control specifically is fairly unique in terms of the way that it impacts a person's psyche and also the way that it impacts their ability to have a healthy relationship with the person or people that are trying to help them. Mm-hmm. You know, because people kind of go one of two ways, which is not uncommon with trauma. People tend to react to trauma in extremes. They either don't want anyone ever having that kind of quote unquote power over them again. They don't want to see a therapist. They don't want anyone who's in like a one-up mm-hmm. position, right? Which I totally get that. If you've been through that, I completely understand. Or they come to therapy and they have a really hard time voicing their needs. You know, when I say something that triggers them or when something comes up that they're not happy with, they just kind of are like, well, okay, I guess I'll go along with this instead of saying, hey, that actually really triggered me. Right. So it's good to be mindful about that when you're working with folks who've been, you know, through the ringer of coercive control, that can kind of have its own unique challenges as well.
What do you say to the people that are denying that they've been through trauma?
I mean, I don't deal with this super often because obviously people come to me generally because they want to recover from trauma. But I've definitely worked with my share of people who have been through something. And I gotta say, it's typically people who have been through some sort of sexual assault that they are maybe not in a place of being willing to see that what happened was an assault or was trauma or rape yeah. or whatever term you want to use for it. And it's always kind of a delicate dance because, you know, you don't want to just be like, oh, that was trauma, you know, if you don't think the person is ready to hear that. And
for sure.
I've never really worked with a person who just was like, that wasn't trauma. I don't want to talk about it. Leave it alone. It's more kind of been a gentle back and forth of like, well, based on my experience, I've worked with people who've been through this and it kind of meets the earmarks of trauma, but I'm also not going to tell you how to perceive your own experience. You know, I'm not going to say like, I'm the expert. That's trauma. Mm-hmm. You better believe it. You know,
especially if they've come out of a hierarchy.
Yeah,
cult.
Exactly.
Yeah, situation. Right. Yeah. That's the slippery.
Yeah.
Slope.
And I'll just say, you know, you are absolutely entitled to your perception of what happened. And it's okay for us to hold different perceptions of it right now. That's fine.
And I can imagine some people just going, that's too hard to deal with.
Yeah. And that's why it's important when you're working in trauma recovery. And I say this to clients all the time, but this is for clinicians too. You can't just barrel ahead.
Right.
Right. Like there are times where you need to pause or be like, we're just going to have to revisit that another time because it's too much. It's too overwhelming. It's flooding. It can even be re-traumatizing to try to like get in there and try to convince somebody to see something a certain way. So trauma work is really a delicate balance between like pushing and challenging and also knowing when to take a break from pushing and challenging.
And where does PTSD and complex PTSD fit into that? And could you maybe break that down a little bit for our listeners? Because that's a term we use, but we've never really explained it.
Yes. So the book that we use in America to diagnose mental health issues is called the DSM. And then internationally, the book that's used is called the ICD. And they line up frequently, but not always. They're definitely different. And so at this point in time, in the DSM, which is what we use in America, the diagnosis is post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. There is no diagnosis of complex PTSD at this time. This book changes every few years, so who knows what the future will hold, right? But in the worldwide book, the ICD, there's PTSD and then there's complex PTSD. So that's the one where it's kind of recognized at this point.
Okay.
And all the politics of those two books is just more than we need to get into.
Save that for another.
Yeah, that's a whole nother discussion. Yeah. But so when it comes to PTSD, as I was mentioning earlier, there are these different categories of symptoms. You have to have a certain number of each one to qualify for a diagnosis. And roughly those are intrusive symptoms, like having intrusive thoughts or nightmares or things like that. They are avoidance, that you avoid things that remind you of what happened, negative thoughts and mood related to what happened to you, and what they call arousal or reactivity. And that's things like being irritable, having an exaggerated response when people startle you, hypervigilance, things like that.
I mean, I think I could share this. Whenever I'm driving and Sarah's in her phone.
Even if I'm not in my phone.
But normally it manifests like this. I'll be driving and I'll be braking for a stoplight and she'll be on her phone. She'll lift her head up. She'll go, "Oh my God."
Now, my startle is not just you, Nip. When anyone's driving, if they don't stop like quickly enough, or like I feel like there's a car ahead and they're not slowing down, I brace for accident. And I know that I'm fine, but it's like just totally a physical response.
Yeah, that can be exaggerated startle response, maybe a little hypervigilance, you know, a little bit of both.
I totally have hypervigilance.
And then when we get to complex PTSD, it's all of those things that I just said, plus kind of three other areas, which are problems in your interpersonal relationships, just problems like forming and maintaining healthy relationships, having trouble regulating how you express your emotion, and also having significant negative self-concept or thoughts or ideas about yourself. So it's kind of like PTSD plus these three things. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the difference. And another potential differentiation, although this one is not official, is that oftentimes people who have been through what we call like single incident trauma, like somebody who survives like a horrible car accident or a shooting or something like that, but they have no other trauma history, if they develop PTSD, it will likely be PTSD, not complex PTSD. Mm-hmm. Whereas people who have been through chronic repeated trauma,
like ongoing abuse,
whether it's in childhood or adulthood, or unfortunately both, that tends to manifest more as complex PTSD when it's been kind of chronic, repeated over months or years.
Well, that's my non-clinician, not therapy observation as a child, only a therapist and a cult survivor, is that a lot of the survivors we seem to interact with have complex PTSD, especially the negative self-talk, the 0 to 100 emotional outbursts, and certainly all the things that you said before for both, and at least for me being hypervigilant. I don't know if I have the negative self-talk thing, but there's self-doubt that I think almost everybody has exiting a cult.
Self-doubt's healthy. I mean, I wouldn't throw it under a PTSD unless it's extreme.
A certain amount of self-doubt is healthy. Yeah. But when you take it to an extreme, then it can become debilitating. Yeah.
It's healthy. Yeah.
Hey, a little bit culty listeners. Bless your little bitty hearts for helping support this podcast. You asked us to put a link up where you could make a one-time or monthly contributions to help us cover the costs of taking this podcast from our living room to your earbuds. And so we did. And wow, you weren't kidding around when you said you wanted to help this podcast keep on cranking out episodes. You stepped up. Thank you. In fact, in a relatively short time, 70 of you have already chipped in. And together, the whole beautiful lot of you have covered the cost of making almost 5 full A Little Bit Culty episodes. That's pretty freaking good. You are amazing. Did you know that? And yes, we're talking to you, Veronica Wells, Annie Blake, Thomas Wicks, and John Breen, and you, Kenny Bernstein, and Kristen O'Rourke. You rule, Sarah Priestley and Roger Seidman, and you are rad. Andrea Padillas, Helena Durst, Sally Lotz, Joel Blair, and Jolene Bishop. That's just a few of you who are helping to make this podcast happen. Want to make a contribution? Just go to alittlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio. Every little bit helps keep A Little Bit Culty trucking along. Thanks again. We adore you. Do you have like a couple of nuggets, tools in your toolbox that we could share with our listeners of daily habits to counteract those things?
A way that I like to explain PTSD and CPTSD to people is that it's kind of like a broken time machine, where when you have PTSD or CPTSD, your brain and your nervous system can go from the present to the past in a heartbeat. Right? It's like a time machine you don't have any control over. You know, one time a trigger might, you know, difficult, but you're mostly here in your adult self and you're able to handle it. And another time that same trigger can make you feel like you're 10 again, right? You're this like helpless child in this awful situation or whatever your story may be, right? So I think it's good to remember for people to remember that feeling like your brain and your nervous system get the past and the present mixed up is extremely normal with this issue, right? That's part of the deal. And the way that I try to help people in terms of nuggets is that when your brain and nervous system get, you know, thrown into the past at some point, you've got a couple of options in terms of coping skills. You can try to do things to bring yourself back to the present moment, to reorient yourself to the present. The most well-known example of that is the 5-4-3-2-1 technique. I don't know if you guys are familiar.
Tell us.
There's different versions of it. This is by no means the version, but it's like, okay, literally saying out loud if you can, or to yourself if you can't, what are 5 things I can see right now? What are 4 things I can hear right now? What are 3 things I can feel on my skin? What are 2 things I can smell? And then the one thing I usually go for, what's one thing I'm grateful for, but it can literally be anything else. But it's like you're using your 5 senses to be like, I am here and now. I am not 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I am in the present moment. Right.
I'm not going to say I actually did those things, but I do remember being in situations where I felt detached. And then when I have my kids, I would immediately just go right into the world. Being a parent forced us to evaluate what's more important.
And also to be present.
Going off and playing in our brains, or what's right in front of us and what we're raising. And it allowed us to be, the word grounded, I don't know if is the appropriate word, but allow us to have joy in our lives during a traumatic situation, remind us that there's going to be kind of a light at the end of this. And that's temporary. Just holding that space in my head, I think, kind of kept me going.
Yeah. It's like an informal version of what Natalie just said.
You can't go in the past or the
future.
Right.
Kids are very much here right now.
An option. So what are you enjoying that I'm
exactly
not seeing?
So there's trying to bring yourself back to the present, and then there's also, if you feel like that's maybe not doable for you in the moment, then there's ways to try to like soothe yourself while you're experiencing this unwanted trip to the past. An example of that would be, I really like Kristen Neff. She's this psychologist who's done a bunch of work on self-compassion. Her kind of 3-step self-compassion process is to, number one, say what's going on. So if you're somebody who feels like you're back and you're 10 years old, you say, you know, I'm really suffering. I feel like I'm never going to get out of this. I feel really hopeless and awful. Then number two is to remind yourself that you're not alone, that you're connected to other people who are maybe not doing so great in this moment. And then number three is to do something concrete to comfort yourself. So she'll say, like, you know, to give yourself a hug or put a hand on your heart and just say, like, if you would to a child, like, it's going to be okay, sweetie. We're going to get through this. This is going to end. So to do something like that, to at least try to comfort yourself until you can come back to the present.
I really like that one. And that's certainly something that came up in my early trauma therapy when I first got into NXIVM, because I realized I didn't know how to self-soothe.
Most people don't.
Yeah, I didn't anyway, even before NXIVM. And then in NXIVM, I was taught that I didn't even have those needs. Those needs were not legitimate. Yeah. And then I came out and
you're making up for lost
time. I'm making up for lost time. But that's something that I've learned to even express to Nippy when I get anxious or I'm triggered and I can be irritable and all sorts of things.
You're human, whatever.
Yeah, I'm human. But that's us. Like a lot of people have asked us over this podcast, like how have we survived as a couple and what are some of the things? And I think that's one of the things I've learned to do is to say to Nippy,
bath bombs.
Yes, bath bombs. But in terms of therapy,
it's been great. It's made gift giving really easy.
For me to say to you, I'm really upset right now. I just need, because there's been times where you're like, I don't know how to deal with you. Like you're crazy right now. And it's true. I've been like borderline nervous breakdown over the last 5 years, multiple mm-hmm. times. I don't even know what you'd call it. But in those moments, Nippy is sometimes like, this is not my jurisdiction. I don't know what to do. I'm like, all you need to do is hug me. That's all I want right now is a hug. And there was a while that I couldn't even communicate that because I'd been taught that I don't have any needs. Anything I want from the outside world, anything I'm attached to is just my own disintegration and my own deficiency. And I have to evolve mm-hmm. that. So yes, I need to learn to self-soothe, but there's in a partnership to be able to say like, can you just hold me for a minute? Like that's all I need.
Yeah, definitely.
So both, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioning being on the verge of a nervous breakdown makes me mm-hmm. think of one other thing that might be helpful for folks, which is the window of tolerance. Have you guys talked about that before?
Remind me.
So the window of tolerance is this kind of zone where we are in a good space to put it in an inarticulate way, like we're doing okay emotionally, we're pretty balanced, we can take information in, we can engage with the world. And when you're a trauma survivor, triggers or memories or things can throw you outside of your window of tolerance. And people tend to either go one direction or the other, but a lot of people go both. So think of it as an actual kind of like window. Sometimes when something triggers you, you go up into what we call hyperarousal. And that is emotional dysregulation. You can't calm down. You're kind of all over the place crying. You know, you can't sit still, that sort of thing.
That's me.
Or sometimes people also go down into hypoarousal, which is where you shut down. You numb out, you dissociate, you maybe even fall asleep. Right.
That's Nippy. Yeah. Nippy's,
oh my God.
Nippy's raising his hand. Yeah. This is why this is explains everything. Natalie, we should pay you. How much is your hourly rate?
So it's good to know for people, for number one to know, do you always tend to go in one direction or can you go either way? Because it's different for every person. And then it's important to figure out what coping skills will help you. Because if you're in hyperarousal, you need coping skills that are going to calm you down. Right? Bring you back into the window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're in hypoarousal, you need to be like woken up, activated to be brought back up into your window of tolerance, right?
Working out, sir.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. No, like cardio is a coping skill for when you're in hypoarousal because it forces your body to start like waking up.
It gets my endorphins going. We saw someone.
A therapist.
And they tried to write a prescription for, what was it, Sarah? Like,
well, basically they said, Sarah, you've got anxiety, Nippy, you've got depression. I mean, that's a more just sort of basic.
No shit. Yeah. look what I just fucking went through.
We're like, thanks for that. Great analysis.
Didn't need that.
One other tidbit about the window of tolerance that it's good to keep in mind is that it's not static. It is constantly expanding and shrinking. There are times when we're doing especially well, we're pretty resilient, like your window of tolerance is big. It's going to take a lot to throw you out of it. And then there are other times where either things in your life or things in the world or both have your window of tolerance. Like it's just this little tiny little slit, you know, that anything, one thing goes wrong and you're thrown out of it.
You're thrown.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you just kind of explained the last 5 years because I think, you know, Nippy and I are truthfully doing surprisingly well considering what we've been through. And I think so, even just being able to make this podcast is a sign of that. And we've grown tremendously through it. But I think the times when we've been at major conflict is when I'm in the hyper and he's in the hypo and we're just so far apart because not only am I so hyper and I'm all the things you said, but then I get resentful that he's so like gone, you know, and he's probably so resentful that I'm so out there. Like we're just so nowhere near each other. And then when we're in the same window of tolerance, like when we flow just to have that sort of like those new words to be able to say like, Nippy, we've started this new thing where we do a little power meeting in the morning and like go through all the things we're going to try to accomplish together today. And then at the end of the day, we check in because otherwise I tend to like fire machine gun questions and like things at him throughout the day. And he's like, I'm not in that mode. So like we've have designated times for like talking about and plant because I'm a massive planner.
It's funny to hear your assessment. Yeah, yeah. Well, quite enjoyable. Yeah.
Yeah, my point is that I feel like now we have a new word. Be like, so where are you in your window of tolerance? Like, how are you doing? Yeah.
There's also versions to explain it to kids as well. You'd need to look those up because I'm not as well versed in that since I don't work with kids. But it can also be really helpful for kids too to understand that concept. And to give credit where credit is due, that is from Dan Siegel, who's a big name in the field. So he's the one who kind of came up with that conceptualization.
Do you have any tips for our listeners how to find a therapist?
Oh gosh, yes. So I know that you guys are in Canada, so it's a different situation.
We are moving to Atlanta.
You are. Oh my goodness. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks. Most of our listeners are in the US.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
So what I would suggest, you kind of got two options. It's like, are you looking for somebody who takes insurance or can you pay out of pocket? That's a whole nother podcast episode about how broken the healthcare system is in America.
I was going to say.
I hate that I have to explain this to people because it should be so much easier and better, but this is how it is. So if you're looking for somebody who's out of pocket, you're going to have an easier time.
Okay.
If you do that, I would just suggest that you go to Google and you type in Psychology Today Therapist Finder. It's certainly not the only online directory for therapists, but it is the biggest one.
Right.
So I would go to that. I would filter it for whatever issue you're looking for and start contacting people. If you're going the route of you need somebody who's in network with your insurance, it is going to be a tougher battle, I'm sorry to say. You should still start with the Psychology Today Therapist Finder.
Okay.
You should filter for your insurance. And then you should contact at least 10 therapists. Because some people, I say that and they're like, that sounds like a lot. And this is based on years of experience trying to help people find people in network with their insurance company. Because if you contact 10, you'll probably hear back from 5. And there will be maybe 2 or 3 good options from those 5. And this is for a host of reasons. A lot of people who take insurance are ridiculously overworked and underpaid, so they don't have time to respond to everybody who reaches out to them. And most of them are booked full. So it's hard to find somebody who A, responds to you, and B, has space. That is how I would suggest people do that.
Got it.
Once they're, if it's specifically for people who are recovering from cults, anything specifically that you'd say to them about like what you're looking for or asking them, like, you know, other than do you have any education in cult recovery? Like what's other than the obvious?
Sure. I think that the first obvious thing would be you need to find somebody who's a trauma specialist.
Okay.
Regardless of if they know much about cults or not, start with that pool. And then once you get to that pool, start to try to look for people who mention things on their websites or their profiles about cults, religious trauma, things like that. And if you don't find anything, then absolutely ask them during the consult. A lot of people don't realize that most therapists do free consultations, like 15-minute phone call, whatever. And that is not just for the therapist to ask you questions. That is also for you to ask the therapist questions. And that is when you should say, do you have any knowledge or experience in this area?
Right.
Right. In my opinion, you shouldn't have to pay somebody for a first session to find that out.
I agree. Yeah. I have a psychologist that I've been working with for a couple of years since leaving, who's not cult informed at all, trauma informed a little bit, I think, but he just, in some ways, my first 3 sessions were just explaining
what he was looking at.
Yeah. What he was looking at. And then in some ways it was interesting because he asked questions that were so like, because he didn't have the cult, but that were actually great. But he'd be like, wait, so you have no needs? So like, so those are needs for to survive. What about needs to thrive? Like actually have a full, and I was like, oh, that's why everyone was so miserable, because we weren't allowed to have anything that was like, because we're just called attachments. Mm-hmm. Things that you were striving for that you wanted to make you happy were made bad as attachments. And I was like, oh my God, I can have those things again and be okay.
Yep.
Just a quick NXIVM tangent. I don't know if we've ever told this story, but the other day I said to Nippy, I think she'll think you'll appreciate this as a therapist, is that they said that emotions were that like when you have the world the way that you want it, like your expectations lined up with the world the way that it is, that's happiness.
Oh.
So the audience, they could see my like hands aligned and they would call that worlds aligned. Mm-hmm. And that when you're upset, it's your worlds are not aligned. The world is not the way you want it to be. So the happier you are, it's just because your worlds are aligned.
Or your attachment is being met.
And so even if you were happy, it was not okay, because they would say, well, you're just afraid that it's going to come apart again. So there's fear underneath the happiness.
Oh, gosh.
Right?
Oh, boy. So you can never really be happy.
You can never really be happy. There was transcendent joy that you were working towards in a sort of like Buddhist enlightenment kind of way. And Keith would say there's the happy path and then there's the joy path. And most people are just on the happy path and they're just trying to do things to make you happy. And of course, we all know happiness does not come from the outside world.
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes it does. In the form of many good things, including children, which was also an attachment, according to Keith.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, so I just thought you'd appreciate that. And the other day, I was having a good moment. I said, oh, my God, my worlds are so aligned right now, Nippy. And then I was like, what did I just say? Oh, no, I just said it's like 5 years out. And I just said it.
Wow,
like,
it's okay. Yeah, it's hard to shake that stuff. And it's interesting. I thank you for sharing that with me, because it makes me think about working in addiction, because so much of addiction work is about acceptance and about how the world will not always be in alignment with how you want it to be. And unless you want to suffer, you really need to find acceptance around certain things. That ultimately is much more realistic than trying to get the world to line up with how you want everything to be.
Yeah. I mean, understanding that your expectations are not always reality is that is a nugget I got from my work there that I do hold to be true and helpful, because that's good to be more fluid about that in life, right?
Sure. Yes,
absolutely. A tool set. But now I'm really working towards doing things that, quote, make me happy, which I would never have said in NXIVM, because that would be, quote, out of cause. That's not an at cause statement. Nothing can make me happy. I make myself happy, which there's some truth in that, but that also can be used against you when you're being hurt and abused.
Yeah.
That's my ass chapping, is like how these beautiful statements about living healthfully can be twisted for the leader's gain, you know? Nippy, did you have an ass chapping before Natalie's?
No, I was going to ask Natalie.
Oh, yeah, Natalie, what's yours? About the industry or about, like, you know?
Sure. I would say, I mean, the looking for a therapist thing, just, you know, the constant ass chap of the way that healthcare in America works, especially mental health care, but the whole thing. And then I would just say, yeah, that we've made a lot of strides in therapists and psychologists understanding cults and coercive control, but we've got a long way to go. And that definitely chapped my ass.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a good one. Do you have one, Nip?
I was thinking about why that might exist and the bureaucracy of it, but it's no different than why other bureaucracy stuff exists. Someone stands to gain from not having people aware to a certain level. It keeps the abuses in place.
I also don't really understand, like, even just trying to help people get therapists, like this whole people can't be therapists across state lines thing. Like, I'm trying to connect people who need therapists. And I'm like, I know this person, like, you know, Natalie in LA, but you're like, how does that, why can't you do it across state lines?
There's a thing called SciPact. I think it's a thing in like over half the states now. It's a thing to try to allow for across state lines practicing. However, it's not going to be a thing in California for a while for political reasons that I won't even get into, but I disagree with and think are ridiculous.
Thank you so much, Natalie.
Of course.
I feel like we got a lot personally. Best part of
well, thank you.
Best part of our job.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad that we connected. I mean, thank you for doing the Bentino Mazzaro stuff, because that's what got my attention. And then that's what connected us. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate this opportunity. Everything that you guys have done in this realm has just been so amazing. I hope you guys can keep doing it.
Oh, thanks, Natalie. That means a lot to us.
Of course.
Yeah. It's worth it. Thank you for that therapy session.
You're welcome.
Super helpful.
That was great. My tolerance just flew through the roof.
Imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees. High above you, the air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like, is offered purely as commentary. Because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A Little Bit Culty loves you.
That was so interesting and so helpful, I think, for both of us. And on that tangible, practical level, I also want to share that we are very proud to be working with ICSA this year for the annual conference online.
What's ICSA, Sarah?
Oh, thanks for asking, Nippy. The International Cultic Studies Association. And from June 24th to 26th, there is incredible online conferences. There's actually going to be over 60 sessions, 70 speakers, 5 workshops. The conference theme is exploring the needs of people who leave controlling groups, relationships, and environments. So I think a lot of our listeners would benefit from this. Nippy and I will be having a booth. I'm not sure what that means. If it's
a kissing booth, Sarah?
I don't actually know. It's a virtual online booth. We're going to find out more. No. But I wanted to put the plug
in. We should build one in our house and then...
kiss in it?
No, well, you know.
I don't know.
Slow down.
Okay. So anyway, check out the ICSA Annual Conference 2022 online and hope to see you there. And you know what I realized is that I don't know if there's any therapy-related word salad, but maybe you could just share something. Have you found any good ones recently?
Yeah. If there's therapy-based word salad, you have the wrong therapist.
Yeah, for real. Like, that's a good indication you need a new therapist.
Run. Look, I hate to keep banging on the bento box, sorry, not sorry, but goddamn, does this dude come up with some shit. And I can't let him have the hall pass for this one because it's so self-aggrandizing. But here goes. The word salad is in response to a question. What's the difference with my life and yours? And here we go. While you live in a personal world of your own making, experiencing infinite existence through a twisted keyhole made of painfully small ideas, all the while assuming that you know life, I live out beyond the stars, see in all directions, simultaneously, yet still do not assume I know a single thing. When a day has passed for you and you go to sleep as if having added something to yourself that day, I have counted an eternity and go to sleep, not remembering who I was even on that afternoon. It's probably a good thing for you. Your world consists of the tides of pain and pleasure, while mine consists of a steady stream of indestructible bliss. Where you see a world, I see nothing. Where you see nothing, I see the world.
See, I mean, at first that kind of makes sense, like you can follow it. I mean, it sounds totally pompous and holier than thou and putting oneself up on a pedestal, but then it just doesn't actually make sense. That's such a great word salad.
I'm just like, where's the douchebag convention? When is this guy going to be
there? Isn't there a douchebag convention? Didn't he have a free workshop coming up?
I don't know, man. And it goes on. If you go to his page, it's just like...
Anyway. I would actually love for one of our listeners to infiltrate the douchebag convention, his free workshop that's listed on his page, and report back.
I'll do it.
I'm going to save one of the V-Week t-shirts time. For that.
It starts today, actually.
Oh, and you missed
my
it.
My dad's birthday's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I have a son and I have a kid.
I know, I'm not asking you to do it, but that reminds me.
No, I have a kid that's stuck in the tide of pain and pleasure, you know. It's just, you know.
But I do want to say, speaking of that, I really do appreciate everyone who's been sending the stories, showing how they listen to A Little Bit Culty in the background.
Oh, yeah.
We have at least 4 V-Week shirts going out in the mail this week. I'm shocked at how many people want them, but I'm really relieved that I don't have to bring them to Atlanta and that I also don't have to throw them out because I am a pack rat.
Well, we don't have that many, so don't go promising.
I'm not going to overpromise.
The world. All right.
Thanks, guys, for the support. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did.
Deuces.
Peace out. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean. I'm hanging on to the weight of my love. If I let go of it all, I could leave. But I know. Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second.
We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.